Please nobody rise. Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the Committee on Taxes for March 14th, 2024. We do have a quorum present. Vice Chair Norris, do I have a motion on the minutes for March 12th, 2024?
Chair
Gomez. Oh, look out, everyone. Chair Lislegard has come to the front of the pack and moved the minutes for March 12th, 2024. Is there any discussion on the motion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, please say no.
No.
Okay. All right. Well, we got a divided vote there. Motion carries, though, over the strenuous objections of Lee Davids, and the minutes for March 12, 2024 are adopted. So we have three bills on our agenda today. Up first, continuing with Norris Day, we're having Norris Day Part 2, House File 4823. And Vice Chair Norris is going to move that House File 4823 be laid over for possible inclusion in the 2024 tax bill. Welcome back to your committee, Vice Chair Norris. Whenever you're ready, please go ahead and introduce your bill.
All right. Thank you, Chair Gomez, fellow committee members. I'm pleased to present House File 4823. It's a pretty simple bill. It basically builds on the child tax credit that we passed last year. And says that now children who are 18 years of age would also qualify under the tax credit. This tax credit, I think, and most folks hopefully would agree, was one of the best things of last year's tax bill. Independent estimates projected that it would cut childhood poverty here in Minnesota by one-third. And it's hard to envision any other single policy that has that significant of an impact on improving life for Minnesota working families and their children. From my own experience, both having been an 18-year-old living in my parents' house and knowing and working with lots of families across the state, the reality is that most 18-year-olds are still, at home. Most of them are still seniors in high school. They're not off to college or working on their own yet. So it just seems like a natural fit that we should expand this successful child tax credit to include 18-year-olds. And Chair Gomez, I've got a couple of testifiers who will talk further about why this is a great idea.
Great. Thank you very much, Representative Norris. So we do have a couple testifiers who have signed up ahead of time. First on my list, Christine Snyder, welcome to the committee. Great to see you.
Be here. Thank you, Chair and Committee. My name is Christy Snyder, and I'm the Policy and System Transformation Officer at Youth Prize. We are a state intermediary devoted to elevating youth voice and increasing equity for young people in Minnesota. I'm here to testify on behalf of House File 4823, moving the benefits of the Revolutionary Tax Credit up until the child's 19th birthday. While I try not to testify when young people should, the 18-year-olds that I know are currently in school. Before I start, I want to point out a few ways we define youth and young adults in other spaces and the expected support of parents. In the justice system, you are sometimes considered an adult when you are 18. You cannot drink alcohol or use cannabis until you're 21. In the K-12 system, you can be working towards your high school diploma up to age 21. In the youth workforce system, for the Workforce Investment and Opportunity Act, you're counted as a young person until you're 24. For the federal financial aid, your parents factor into your aid until you are 24. The National Institute of Health, Mental Health, illuminates that the brain is still growing and developing up until your late 20s. If you're confused, you're not alone. When are you youth? When are you not a youth? Our systems are not consistent, and for families who are below the poverty line, they are often designed to further punish or hold them to different expectations than others. In our community, I'm often seen as a connector to young adults, to resources. The past few weeks alone, I received a few different requests from teachers and youth workers about young people from families who are below the poverty line who turned 18 during the school year. Family resources plummet, and young people believe that they are expected to make it on their own right on their 18th birthday. One young person chose to leave school to work full-time, leaving behind their high school diploma and more certain economic future that degree holds for immediate needs, food, rent, transportation costs. Young adults receive significant sums of financial aid financial assistance if you're middle class and upper class, but largely informally and inequitably. One analysis found that American parents collectively give their young adult children $500 billion a year of financial assistance. That's from Merrill Lynch in 2020. Yet research shows that large racial and ethnic disparities in parental financial transfers due to structural inequalities in the form of economic resources, family structure, and health. That's Barry 2006. I invite us all to sit with this. It has become more expensive to launch into adulthood, and that we keep most of the true costs hidden. Extending the child tax credit to the age 18, the 19th birthday, will not transform all that our culture needs to do, but it is the right next step. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Ms. Snyder. Appreciate your testimony. Christy was my mom's boss, her last boss, and she is a very good boss from what I understand. So Youth Prize is lucky to have her. Chair Howard.
And a proud Richfield constituent as well.
And a proud Richfield resident, so... Excellent. Thank you for being with us today, Ms. Snyder. And Jess Webster, welcome back to the committee. Please introduce yourself as you're going ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jess Webster. I'm a staff attorney with Legal Aid. I use she, her pronouns. Legal Aid represents Minnesotans statewide who have low wealth or have low incomes. And first, we're speaking in support of House File 4823, but it would be remiss if I didn't say we still have a tremendous amount of gratitude for the passage of the child tax credit last year. Not sure I can think of a more powerful anti-poverty tool in my almost 20 years with Legal Aid. So when we saw the contours of the child tax credit bill last year kind of near the end and we realized that 18-year-old youth were not going to be part of the larger child tax credit, we had hoped it was a conversation for another day, so we really appreciate that the committee is looking and considering this change. From Legal Aid's perch and the families I represent at these income levels, these are meaningful dollars. It's rent, it's transportation, and not to mention the fact that we are facing an acute crisis in the cost of food right now. Our dollars don't go as far as they used to, and our emergency food network is really struggling to keep up. So these are meaningful dollars to these families. I think it's been mentioned, 18-year-old youth don't cost less than 17-year-old youth. And in the families that Legal Aid represents, it's not rare for some of these 18-year-olds to be contributing small amounts of money from their earnings toward food and toward rent. It's not something that privileged 18-year-olds really have to think about or be burdened with. So this is smart and equitable tax policy. We appreciate it. We appreciate your consideration. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Webster. Is there anybody else here who wishes to testify on this bill before we move to member questions? Not seeing anyone. Are there any member questions or comments on this bill? All right, seeing none. Representative Robbins.
Sorry.
Yeah, no, you're good.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Norse. So this might be for nonpartisan, but it says that the fiscal or the revenue note, the calculation was limited to returns with only one child to get the average change in credit per child. So I get why you did that, but assuming in reality families might have more than one child that hits this, do you think materially it would change the cost?
Cynthia or Ms. Templin, could you take a stab at that?
Madam Chair, Representative Robbins, yes, I see in the estimate that the department did use tax year 24 and did do a calculation for the average per child for one child for that tax year. In terms of the cost, with that average, they then multiplied that average times the number of returns that they think would benefit under this proposal to get at the total revenue loss. So I think that the revenue estimate does pick up the cost of multiple children per return. And the estimate also did note that they increased the estimate by 15% to account for newly eligible returns and children of ITIN users. So I think some adjustments have been done. But I can also look into this, and if there is something that is missing, I will get back to you.
Thanks.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Great. I think that's a good question, and maybe we'll just see if we can pull together some more information from the department, because, you know, Ms. Templin is our interpreter of the revenue estimates, but she doesn't write them. But that's a really good question, and so we'll get some information for the committee on that and follow up. So thank you. Are there any other questions or comments before we go back to the author? Okay. Vice Chair Norris.
Thanks again, Chair Gomez, and nothing real further to add. I just think this is a great program that we started last year, and it only makes sense to extend it to the 18-year-old children as well.
Great. Thank you so much. With that, Vice Chair Norris will renew his motion that House File 4823 be laid over for possible inclusion in the 2024 tax bill, and it is laid over. Next up on the agenda is House File 4831. The author is Representative Gomez, and we'll just be taking a moment here.
All right. Well, we're doing the switcheroo here. Chair Gomez moves that House File 4831 be laid over for possible inclusion in the 2024 tax bill. Chair Gomez, welcome to your committee. Feel free to proceed with an introduction of House File 4831.
Thank you very much, Chair Norris and members of the committee. So House File 4831 really builds on work that we did in the tax bill last year. As this is actually kind of a Vice Chair Norris's presentation about expansion of the tax bill covered sort of what a transformational investment this is in our community, in our families across the state. And this is a big change, especially because there is families who don't earn income who otherwise don't have to file a return in order to access this benefit. And so there is a need to reach out into community to make sure that people know that this change is happening. And we appropriated some money last year in order to support that work, some money to the Department of Revenue, which then went to some nonprofit organizations or tribal nations that have relationships in communities who are traditionally less well represented in those filing returns. And so it wasn't just the changes to the child tax credit that were in the bill last year. There also were changes to tax credits and homestead status for individuals who file using individual tax identification numbers. We're doing a big transformation of the renter's credit from a freestanding property tax refund to a refundable income tax credit. There were changes to the homestead property tax refund and other things that we know that our communities just need support in kind of understanding new benefits and understanding, kind of the way that they're able to file and access those benefits. And so House File 4831 basically doubles two appropriations that we made last year. One is, the first is it adds $1 million in fiscal 25 for taxpayer outreach grants, and those were the grants that I was just referring to that we work with partner organizations on in order to get the word out to community. The other part of this is adding $750,000 for VITA sites. So these are, a lot of us know about these sites. They are around the state, and they help low-income individuals. They're enshrined in the Internal Revenue Code, and they help low-income individuals file their taxes. I think that the limit for this year, the income limit for this year is $64,000. We'll have some experts up to talk a little bit more in depth about the VITA program. This is really a critical program, not only here in the metro, but across the state. Chair Rest and I had the privilege of visiting over the interim the White Earth Investment Initiative in Detroit Lakes, Minnesota. And so we learned about from them about the work that they're doing as a VITA site in serving that entire region and especially the White Earth Band of Ojibwe. And, you know, there are particular state tax implications for people who are enrolled members of federally recognized tribes, and also just a lot of people who need, you know, that assistance directly. The use of funds for VITA sites is very limited because there's a lot of regulations around it because it's a federal program and it really relies on volunteers. And if any of us have been involved in kind of community service over the last few years, you know, we know that there's really been a drop off kind of during COVID of just volunteerism writ large. And that's being felt by these organizations. And so they can't directly pay individuals to prepare tax returns for people. But what they can do is, you know, they can use dollars that they get from the federal government and from the state, you know, to coordinate sites, to do outreach, to recruit more volunteers, and to kind of beef up the programs overall. Right now, VITA sites are serving just a few percent of the people who are income qualified for the services. And so, you know, and I was shocked when I talked to these White Earth Investment Initiative folks. I mean, a lot of these sites are getting, you know, $20,000, $40,000. They're very grateful for those dollars, and they're really able to make a lot happen on a very, very limited budget. And, you know, we invest in what we support, and you know, I think it's really important that we support this network of, you know, volunteer tax preparers across the state that touch every one of our communities. And so, you know, that's the other part of House File 4831. It also codifies into statute these programs, which was in kind of an uncodified section last year. Sorry to go on a little long, but I appreciate the time, Mr. Chair.
It's your committee, Chair Gomez. You can go on as long as you want.
Then you're all welcome that I can go on longer.
All right. Thank you, Chair Gomez. We do have a couple of testifiers. First on the list is Willie Gregg. Please step forward and introduce yourself with your name and organization for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Hello. Thank you, Chair Gomez and members of the committee. My name is Willie Gregg. I am a tax and financial services manager at Prepare and Prosper here in St. Paul. We're here to support House File 4831 to increase funding to VITA sites across Minnesota. While Prepare and Prosper is Minnesota's largest VITA or volunteer income tax assistance program, we are one of over 150 free tax prep sites across the state. In 2023, the VITA community in Minnesota served around 50,000 taxpayers, returning close to $100 million of tax refunds back into the hands of hardworking Minnesotans. In addition to filing taxes, we also assist with related financial services that help families manage their finances throughout the year. Tax refunds and tax credits help to stabilize family incomes. They let people look to the future, help them put food on the table, and keep families in their homes. But tax filing can be complex and burdensome for many. Many people lack access to or comfort with technology and the internet. It takes trusted community partners to provide guidance, support, and ensure that Minnesotans are getting high quality, accurate services that VITA sites provide. Everyone working at or volunteering at a VITA site is trained and certified, and sites have a high standard for quality. Running a VITA site is time intensive and costly. We need to recruit, train volunteers, secure locations and technology, and much more. The time, human capital, and technical demands can cause some VITA sites to close every year and prevent others from starting. Large stretches of Minnesota, especially in rural areas, have limited or no access to affordable tax preparation. Families drive regularly, sometimes multiple hours, to have their taxes filed. VITA sites in all parts of the state work creatively with limited resources, but rising costs challenge this important work. New funding would provide a much needed investment to maintain, expand, and adapt our services to better serve our communities. Prepare and Prosper strongly supports HF 4831 to bring these vital services to more Minnesotans across the state.
Great. Thank you very much, Willie Gregg. Next up is Jess Webster. Welcome back to the committee, Ms. Webster. If you could just once again introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Thank you, Chair Gomez. My name is Jess Webster. I'm a staff attorney with Legal Aid. So we are in strong support of House File 4831. We've partnered with VITA organizations for 20 years. We believe they provide a critically important service for preparing and filing taxes and doing outreach to the folks that Legal Aid represents. We're super grateful for their work, and we're grateful for this investment. Beyond tax preparation, filing, and outreach, we also appreciate a provision of this bill that includes taxpayer assistance in terms of personal representation, because personal representation is critically important for low-income families and taxpayers when they run into a problem with their filing. In particular, there is a significant need in our state to help folks with state tax issues. I think Chair Gomez already alluded to it, but you know, access to tax justice is really core to Legal Aid in our tax law project. But at our low-income taxpayer clinics, we're not able to assist folks with state issues and state representation due to our grant restrictions. We often have to turn people away, and we turn people away daily, and we make referrals to the Volunteer Lawyers Network, who can maybe serve a fraction of those folks. And what happens when we turn people away for state representation, sometimes their desperation leads them to hire quote-unquote tax relief businesses, which we find often scam them out of thousands of dollars that they didn't have. And we're then in a position to try to help folks who have been scammed. So the personal representation would really help folks hang on to the resources that are you know, would be available to them. Some of the issues that we see in terms of representation are denial of dependent credits, innocent spouse cases where one spouse is being unfairly burdened with tax debt because the other spouse is an abuser, tax scams, worker misclassification, and then just general help with helping people navigate a really complicated tax system. So we appreciate this bill. We appreciate the investment, and thank you for your consideration.
Thank you, Ms. Webster. All right. Any other members of the public who wish to testify on House File 4831? With that, we'll go to member questions. Representative Egbaje.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate this bill because I think it's really important that we give opportunities for folks to be able to have their tax questions answered and supported. One question I had, maybe your testifiers could answer, but about how many people are currently being served by the program, and then with this bill, about how much more do we think could be served?
Anyone want to take a swing at that one? Chair Gomez.
Mr. Chair, I know that Mr. Gregg said there are 5,000 or 50,000 people currently served across the state by VITA sites. I don't know if we have a stab at what it would be like, it would mean for VITA for us to double this particular line item. But
Willie Gregg, anything else you'd like to add?
It's hard to say, but our numbers are certainly growing back from where they were pre-pandemic, which they were higher than that previously, and so that could help continue with the continuation of growth of the program.
Great. Anything further, Representative Egbaje?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Weiner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And actually, the other representative pretty much asked my question, is number of people served, and do we have record keeping as to, I know there's a number mentioned, does that break down to low income? How do we keep track of exactly where this is serving? Is there a system in place to take care of that?
Willie Gregg.
Yeah, I believe the Department of Revenue can get broken down information about regions and places. That's where I got that number from, was in the department, some representatives over there.
And Mr. Chair?
Yeah, Chair Gomez.
I'm thinking about a document that I know I have upstairs in my office that I don't know if it has geographic breakdown, but it does have over time, numbers over time. And we can work together and then with the department to try to get you some of that information, because I think that's a good question and will also help us to, you know, understand what this investment means, you know, if we're able to make it over time.
So. Great. Thank you. Anything further?
Mr. Chair, I guess like the other representative's question kind of covered mine. I just wanted to understand how the extra investment is going to affect more people and understand how it's affecting people now.
Great. Thanks, Representative Weiner. Chair Lisligard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, Chair Gomez, thank you for bringing this. it's impressive that, you know, you guys are bringing $100 million back to people that need it most. And when I look at people on fixed incomes and retired, there's a lot of people where I'm from that their fixed income is extremely low because they're living longer and their retirement doesn't increase. And so they utilize these programs, and so it's extremely important, and it provides a service. My question is you said that you do about $100 million back to them. How much do we believe that is still on the table and why we need to get out there more?
Willie Gregg.
Yeah, it's hard to know for sure, especially with these expanded tax credits for the child tax credit. I know there's been projection that approximately 10% of the people that are qualified for it are not claiming it, and that's part of the outreach portion of the funding and why we're to try and get people aware of it. And there's certainly people across the state who are unaware of the property tax refund for homeowners and the renter's rebate, and keeping the word out and getting the word out to people across the state in various communities would be very helpful to help people with those burdensome costs and those be aware of that there's money on the table for them. So it's hard to say exactly the amount, but there are certainly quite a few people across the state.
Okay. Anything further?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, so just is there a way to track that over time? I don't know if nonpartisan has an idea.
Mr. Williams.
Chair Norris and Representative Lethbridge, I know that the data I've seen on this as the best is the Internal Revenue Code does an estimate of uptake for the federal earned income credit, so it's not exactly the same as the state credits, but it's kind of a similar population served by the old working family credit and then the child credit. And so the data I have is from 2020, so there's a little bit of a drop. I think it dropped in Minnesota down to about 77% uptake of the earned income credit federally. And it was the year before, I think, 81.5, so, you know, high 70s, low 80% uptake on the federal earned income credit. So that maybe gives you some ballpark. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Chair Lissigard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Chair Gomez, thank you so much for looking out for the little people.
Thank you. Next on the list, we have Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Chair Gomez, for this bill. I just wondered, of the money that was spent last year, it seems like we're doubling it in a non-budget year. So is all of that money already gone, or why are we doing it this cycle instead of after we've seen how it works?
Chair Gomez.
Thank you, Chair Norris, and thank you, Representative Robbins, for that question. We'd have to probably get the department up here for them to talk about how the funds have been expended. But I will say that I've been meeting with the department regularly kind of to get updates about the work and about the organizations that they're getting funds out to. And it sounds like kind of just from the tenor of the questions here that we probably want the department maybe to come and share a little bit more at some point about how this program's working now, how it's interacting with the changes that we made in the 2023 bill. And you know, part of the reason that I thought it was important for us to increase this investment this year was because, you know, so much of the outreach this year has focused on that expanded child tax credit, but there are a couple of other really important changes that will be coming up, including the renter's credit to a refundable income tax credit. You know, we're going to need to look at how the uptake is on the child tax credit, and especially because we are expanding this to people who aren't currently in that population that Mr. Williams referred to, because those folks are in the habit of filing for these refundable income tax credits each year that are targeted for low income people, and we're expanding that out. And the individual tax identification number changes are a big change in a population that a lot of people don't speak English as their first language, and so there's sort of some complication to that. So it was really like about understanding that there are some tax changes that are implemented for this year and others that are going to be really implemented for next year, and knowing that we're going to have to kind of ramp up the outreach efforts. And, you know, I guess I'll just say, like, I live in a city that is densely populated with some of these populations who are not currently maybe participating and leaving money on the table. I sort of like see signs of it some places, and then in a lot of cases actually have been like, oh, you're advertising the working family credit changes, but where's the information about the property tax refund, the homestead refund, the ITIN changes, what's going on next year? And so even within the grantees that are currently getting funds, there's a need to expand what they're doing currently. And so, you know, so that's kind of on the taxpayer outreach. On these VITA sites, it's like these folks are really making do with very, very little, very, very, you know, and we heard Ms. Webster talk about how, you know, they have to turn people away. The number of people that they are able to serve is really limited by this volunteer capacity, which is related to the organization's capacity to recruit volunteers, to set up sites, to set up kind of the infrastructure around them. But I think your question about the outreach grants is a good one, and we need to kind of like get some information and follow up. I mean, the VITA sites kind of have, I don't know, how long has VITA been around? Decades?
Yeah. We've been around about 50 years.
Yeah. So you know, it's sort of a pretty proven program, and you know, Prepare and Prosper, Mr. Greggs is very humble, but, you know, I just know from connecting with people around the country that Prepare and Prosper is well known as one of the best, most effective, you know, kind of holders of a big set of VITA sites around the country. And, you know, when I asked this other organization out west, I was like, well, do you have any like innovations that you think we could put into this thing? Because I'm trying to figure out how to help support like and expand the capacity of VITA sites. And they're like, well, you guys have Prepare and Prosper. Like, they're who we all look to around the country, right? So you know, I just these investments are really, you know, like I said, these guys are making magic happen with pennies, and so I know that they're going to continue to really use those scarce public resources in a really good way. But I appreciate all the discussion.
Anything further, Representative Robbins?
Just a couple. I'll try to be quick. Thank you, Madam Chair. That was a great answer, and I look forward to, you know, learning more. And yes, I'm very familiar with the work of VITA. You guys are terrific. Really appreciate all your hard work. So I have two more questions, real quick. One is on these outreach grants. I mean, we've talked a lot about how they're impacting our communities, and I would love that information. But there's nothing in the bill, and I don't recall it from last year, although I could be wrong, about reporting, especially to the nonprofit organizations, mm-hmm. where they have to report back so that there's some grant management oversight. And I have a bill separately that's trying to create sort of enterprise-wide grant management mm-hmm. processes. And so I just want to flag that I think as a matter of best practice, anytime we're creating grant programs, that should be part of it. And I would encourage you to consider adding some sort of a reporting requirement back to the department. You know, the more we can institutionalize that, it's not punitive. It's helping nonprofits develop their own capacity to grow when they have really good infrastructure for reporting. So I encourage you to think about that. My last question. Sorry, Mr. Chair, Madam Chair.
Yeah, Representative Robbins.
So when the testifier was up there talking about the taxpayer assistance services, before today, before this hearing, I always thought that was really the programs like VITA sites. I didn't know it also involved the personal representation of legal aid. So is that new, or was that how it always was, and we just...
I think we'll call Ms. Webster up.
Yeah. Ms. Webster, to Representative Robbins' question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Robbins. So the VITA sites do not provide personal representation, and legal aid doesn't provide free tax preparation. So we partner, essentially, and we help with the personal representation when there's an issue. So that's where that question came.
Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for that. So in previous iterations of the VITA site, money, were you also included in it? Was providing personal representation always part of what we called taxpayer assistance, or is this a new addition?
Like we might want to go to Mr. Williams on that one.
Chair Norris and Representative Robbins. So there's a definition in the bill, if you look at 2.4 to 2.8, of what taxpayer assistance services are. That language does include providing representation before the Department of Revenue and the Internal Revenue Service, but I don't know if that's the same as legal representation in other circumstances. So this language is new in the bill in that it's being codified. This language is sort of identical to what's been passed when we've done previous funding for taxpayer assistance bills. So one of the things the bill is doing, and this is more of a technical thing than a substantive thing, is it's taking language that is typically traveled as a rider in the state government bill and just gets repeated every year and just moving it into statute so we can say it once here and not say it over and over again. So I'm pretty sure that the language regarding personal representation is the same in the bill as it has appeared previously in riders in the state government bill.
Representative Robbins.
Perfect. Thank you.
Great. Representative Youakim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Madam Chair, for this bill. I just signed on just because it's very important. And in Hopkins, we have a site. I just looked to make sure. But it's at our senior center, and sometimes folks will assume that it's only to help for seniors. And getting that word out is really hard in our community. We have, we're 2 by 2 miles with 65% rental, and 30% of our households make under $35,000 a year. So these new changes will help a majority of our residents, a lot of our residents, and having that information out there is even more important than ever before. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Youakim. Any other questions or discussion from members? Seeing none, we'll go to Chair Gomez for any concluding remarks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks everybody for the questions and comments. And Representative Robbins, thank you for the suggestion about reporting. This bill's being laid over, and so I'm very open to that. So we should just talk more. And you know, I think that we do have to. You know, we know that, like, sometimes when we put something in a tax bill, it sort of goes into this black box. And so we need to make sure, especially when we are, you know, sending public dollars to nonprofit organizations, to ensure that the proper financial controls are in place, that the money is being used in the way that it was intended. And that's something that desire is not, that's not about partisanship. That is, like, all of us as stewards of public dollars, you know, share that goal and are, you know, really troubled by the times when that has not happened in our state, and when, especially, you know, when vulnerable people who are supposed to be served by these dollars end up missing out. So I'm really thankful for that suggestion, and I'm gonna take it and go back and work with the department on it. And that I appreciate the interest in this issue, and I think, again, it's sort of like something that impacts all of our communities and that all of our folks benefit from. And so I think we're gonna just be having more conversations about some of the specifics of these programs as they roll out, and making sure that we're tracking numbers, that we're kind of seeing what the impact of these funds are on the ground. And so thanks, members of the committee and Chair Norris. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Chair Gomez. And with that, Chair Gomez renews her motion that House File 4831 be laid over for possible inclusion in the 2024 tax bill. The bill is laid over.
Excellent. Next up on the agenda, House File 3788, Representative Hansen. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Thanks for being here. Please introduce your bill. Mm-hmm. Oh, sorry. I'm supposed to move it first. I'm going to move that House File 3788 be laid over for possible inclusion in the 2024 tax bill. Representative Hansen, now to your bill.
Thank you, Chair Gomez. And I also believe I have an A2 amendment as well.
Yes. So there's an author's amendment.
A1.
It's coded in your packets. I'm going to move the author's amendment. Is there any discussion on the amendment? Not seeing any. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, please say no. Motion carries. The amendment is adopted, and the bill is in the form the author would like. For the third time's a charm.
Yes.
To your bill.
Thank you, Chair Gomez, and thank you, committee members. House File 3788 is a bill to repeal the tax on illegal controlled substances and to repeal the tax on quote-unquote illegal cannabis, considering that cannabis is now legal in Minnesota. This tax has generated no real notable revenue since its enactment in 1986. Today, this requires that people intending to sell illegal substances purchase tax stamps for their illegal substances from the Department of Revenue. As I'm sure you can imagine, showing up to the Department of Revenue to pay taxes on your illegal drugs is not a common practice. And the revenue, therefore, on this is barely measurable. Additionally, it is uncommon for prosecutors to use this statute, since the revenue is only generated when it has been used as a part of a successful prosecution of another offense that this was tacked onto, more often than not. The forecasted amount in the department's analysis is essentially relatively unpredictable. And it's difficult to accurately forecast, given that the conviction is the only trigger for collection. Minnesota County attorneys are aware of this bill, and they have not taken any official position. The Department of Revenue also does not have an official position, though they testified in the other body yesterday that this is rarely used by them and was not used at all last year, was used one time in 2022, and that they do not use this statute independently. The department has generally only pursued this when an external law enforcement agency has contacted the Department of Revenue to assist with it in adding it on to charges per the request of a county attorney. The department's analysis shows the forecast of just $5,000 in fiscal year 26 and 27 and noted that this is more so potential revenue than expected revenue. There has been zero revenue from this in 2024, and no measurable amount is forecasted for 25 either. I'll also add that this has passed this body with bipartisan support in the House a few sessions ago, and it is bipartisan in both bodies, well, in the one body and hopefully in this body soon today, with this bill today. And with that, I will conclude and ask for your support.
Thank you very much, Representative Hansen. We're going to move to member discussion in a moment. First, if there's anybody present who wishes to testify on this bill, please come up. Not seeing anybody. Representative Davids.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And before I get going with my questions, before we adjourn, I'd like to comment on some things that could be coming before the committee that Great. I was just made aware of. Okay. Where do you start with this thing? What were they thinking in 1986 that the Department of Revenue needed to tax sale of illegal drugs and substances? I don't get it. I'd probably like to do a little bit of research as to who did this. And if it's the Democrats, then I can blame it on them. If it's the Republicans, I will remain completely silent. But as I was reading through this, preparing for today's hearing, all I could think of, this is a tax break for illegal drug dealers on the one hand. On the other hand, how does the department enforce this? I mean, what illegal drug dealer is going to come forward and say, oh, I owe you taxes on this? If I was in the Department of Revenue, I'd be a little nervous. if I'm dealing with illegal drug dealers to collect taxes from them. This law, not put in by any of us, and I hadn't didn't start serving until 5 years after that date. But I just can't believe this, that we would have a statute that says we're going to tax illegal drug sales. I'm going to do some research on this because, or I'll have Sean do some. what were they thinking? What were they thinking? So, you know, I guess, you know, I'm supporting this bill. Because I like tax breaks for everyone. But I think this would be kind of dangerous in a way for the department to have to work with this. And oh, I'm an illegal drug dealer. I sold this much. I owe you this much. How can they even collect $5,000 is what I'd like to know. There's some honest illegal drug dealers, apparently. So that being said, when I was reviewing these issues yesterday for the meeting today, I just, wow. And I kept asking Mr. Moyer, I said, So illegal drug dealers are supposed to pay a tax to the Department of Revenue. I would really hate to be the Department of Revenue that had to collect this stuff. So I think this bill probably cleans some things up. Yes, I didn't like the cannabis bill, but it is the law. So now the statute says it's illegal, but now it's not illegal. And that's a whole nother debate, not for this bill. But and they're going to get tax stamps for illegal substances? Really? You know, I don't know, maybe just a nod to Ms. Bears is, have you ever sold a tax stamp to somebody that has illegal substances? Are you serious? Maybe, could she come down?
Ms. Bears. Or the assistant commissioner, whoever would like to, whoever's in charge of enforcing this statute. Or can give us some insight into those the thoughts, the mens rea, 1986.
So thank you, yes, Madam Chair. And Ms. Bears, the department is selling tax stamps for illegal drugs?
Ms. Bears.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Joanna Bears. I'm the legislative director for the Minnesota Department of Revenue. Madam Chair, Representative Davids. We have had some folks come in and buy stamps. A lot of the folks that are buying the stamps, though, are stamp collectors. and so it's not necessarily are they. It is anonymous record keeping, so we are not keeping track of who is. I mean, we keep track of the stamps, but we don't keep track of who's purchasing it.
So,
Representative.
Madam Chair and Ms. Bear, so if somebody comes in, an illegal drug dealer comes in and is reporting income, do you report that to law enforcement?
Ms. Bears.
Madam Chair, Representative, they would report the income on their income tax statement, but if they were to if they came into the department and asked to buy a stamp, we would not report that to law enforcement because they'd be paying the tax.
Well,
Representative.
Madam Chair and Ms. Bears, do any of these illegal drug dealers actually file returns? They must if there's revenue that's going to be short.
Ms. Bears.
Madam Chair, Representative Davids, you know, I don't know if they file or pay taxes. You know, they don't, I would guess they don't probably put their trade on their return as selling illicit drugs, but maybe. I know, you know, a lot of this stuff with the stamps and the way that we've used it in the past is there's law enforcement has used it in the past a lot. When there's been kind of trafficking that's happened, then they have applied the stamp after the fact, saying that the tax was not paid on the stamp.
Well, Madam Chair, and to Ms. Bears, does the department support the Hansen bill?
Ms. Bears.
Madam Chair, Representative Davids, we have no position on the bill.
Representative Davids.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. To the department, I think you should have one. because this is a bit frightening in all seriousness to have the department have to enforce something like this. So I'm supporting the Hansen bill, not because I support the new cannabis law or any of that stuff, just because if you have a law that's really unenforceable, the question can become, why do you have it? Yeah. And so on both of these issues with illegal cannabis controlled substances, wow. See, that's why I run so hard and go door to door every election, because this is awesome if you think about it for just a second. So you learn something new every day, and I like that, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Representative Davids. That was delightful. We have a couple other questions, comments. Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Chair. I'm wondering about the constitutionality of this in the first place. I just don't know if Representative Hansen or anybody else knows. I guess the original federal stamp tax on cannabis was declared unconstitutional. It sounds like there were some other state ones. I'm just wondering if you're aware of whether ours has been looked at or kind of what the situation is around the country, because it does seem like it's a violation of your protection against self-incrimination by doing this at all.
Excellent point. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Chair Gomez, and thank you, Representative Pinto. I do not have an answer for you about that, and I will defer to the lawyer caucus of this body to answer that question.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Chair. I'm not going to try to answer it, I guess. I mean, hopefully we can just get rid of it, then we won't have to worry about this. And then the other thing I'm just curious about is it seems like in at least one of the other states when they got rid of this, there was a lot of money that came in because there were stamp collectors who wanted to come in and collect. I'm just wondering, is the revenue note taking into account? Yeah, there's at least one buyer right over there. If we can get if that's taken into account, because right now it looks like it's $5,000 a year, and presumably it's not taking into account the administrative savings of having this unenforceable laws, Lee David's pointed out, and then also the amount of money that we can probably make from selling these things to collectors. So, all right, thanks, Chair.
Thank you, Representative Pinto. Representative Elkins.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. So Representative Davids and I are probably both old enough to probably the only ones in this room who remember how did the feds finally get Al Capone and send him to Alcatraz?
Madam Chair.
Representative Davids.
It wasn't murder. It wasn't selling drugs. It was tax evasion.
Yep. Representative Elkins.
That's exactly right. Al Capone, they couldn't get him on anything else, so they got him on income tax evasion and sent him to Alcatraz. I think that this is probably that kind of a thing.
Steve, you're not that old.
I learned it in high school.
But Master, why does he think I remember?
we'll let the record reflect that Representative Olson did not object to somebody implying that Lee Davids was around in 1931. And hopefully, Representative Elkins, you don't think this is the key to us catching the next Al Capone, and by getting rid of it, we'll be deferring that prosecution. Up next, Representative Joy.
Actually, I just
counseled. You good? Okay.
Highlighted me.
Representative Witte.
Thank you, Chair Gomez. Representative Elkins, I was going to use that same line. but at least we would have known we had a tool out there in law enforcement when we were going after the illegal drugs. We could have went after them on the tax part. But seriously, Representative Hansen, are you concerned at all that this could have potentially induce a black market movement on cannabis products, so you know, trying to avoid the tax piece from the sales?
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative Witte. That's a fair question. It was also brought up in the other body yesterday, and so I'm happy to address that because I think it is on the top of a lot of folks' minds. And at that time yesterday, the Department of Revenue testified that the forecast has taken into consideration some of the experiences that other states who have legalized and what their experience with a tax stamp like this has caused. I am really confident in the criminal provisions and fines that we have put into the criminal penalties for sale and distribution and illegal possession of cannabis, that is an accurate mechanism to be using. Of course, we always want to continue to explore that. If we think increasing those penalties would make it more effective, I would be open to that conversation. Additionally, I think that there's just very little research to say that this type of tax stamp is an effective tool to actually initiate or impose a deterrent. I think the more common practice you would find is that people find the criminal penalties and the fines to be the effective deterrent or the more effective deterrent.
Representative Witte. Good, great. Is there any further discussion on House File 3788? Representative Wiener.
I guess, thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to make it publicly known that I think the people who are not collecting taxes on illegal cannabis are not paying their fair share. So I would like to see that change. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Wiener.
Madam Chair. Madam Chair.
Representative Davids.
To the fine representative, what is the fair share?
Representative Wiener.
Thank you. I knew this would get started. It's a subjective number, and since this is an illegal substance and a legal process already, you know, we can quantify that through a series of meetings and studies. And exactly. Thank you, Mr. Olson.
Whatever Representative Wiener's feelings say it is, I think, is the answer. All right. You good? All right. Is there any further discussion? Seeing none, Representative Hansen, thank you. This has been great. Great fun. If you have any closing comments for us.
No, thank you, Chair Gomez. I appreciate the committee's conversation on this. I think it's been really well thought out, and I've appreciated all the conversation and questions I can answer. I stand open to answer any further as this moves along in the process, but I thank you for your support.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Representative Hansen. With that, I will renew my motion that House File 3788, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion in the 2024 tax bill, and it is laid over. All right, members, our next meeting. Oh, I'm so sorry. We're not going to adjourn just yet. You can go. You're good. Unless you want to hear. I mean, I'm intrigued by Representative Davids's comment. So, Representative Davids.
Well, the press release is already out that I support tax breaks, so just so you know. That being said, there's an issue coming forward that I was made aware of yesterday, and it may be coming. It's kind of late, but I guess our friends across the river to the east in Wisconsin have passed a bill, and it has been signed by the Governor Evers. Well, anyway, the issue is income tax reciprocity. And just a little bit of history, back in the early 2010, 11, in there somewhere, Governor Pawlenty stopped tax reciprocity with Wisconsin. Why did he do that? The reason he did that was because they weren't paying their bill. They owed us like $120 million, and they weren't paying it. So, believe it or not, one reason I have great interest in this is because at the time, the county that had the most people that were hurt by not having tax reciprocity with Wisconsin was actually Houston County, because the regional center's on the other side of the river. It's La Crosse, even more than apparently Duluth and Superior and the Twin Cities and Hudson. That's the way it was back then. I don't know what it is today. But this is a very important issue for several legislators in this legislature, and probably some. We also have it with, I think, North Dakota and actually Michigan, because some Duluth folks actually work on the UP. I didn't realize that, but they do. So that's who we currently have it with. Well, Wisconsin, how do I say it nicely? We had meetings with Wisconsin legislators. They came over here. I don't know if we went over there, but so we had all these meetings on how to get this thing going again, and it just wasn't working. And so what I did as tax chair, working with Commissioner Bowerly, I said, okay, we don't have tax reciprocity with Wisconsin, but why don't we put in law to have the same percentages and the same tax rate as if we did have tax reciprocity. So that's what we did. So we have tax reciprocity with Wisconsin now without Wisconsin being involved. So it's kind of a, never underestimate my sneakiness, sneaky, sneaky. And then what we did was brilliant, working with Commissioner Bowerly. And to get this done, now they do, the problem is they have to file two tax returns. Under reciprocity, they only had to file one. At the time, Wisconsin wasn't really so interested in Minnesota because they were working on a compact for tax reciprocity with a much bigger player, Illinois, and much bigger when it came to the dollars. Now, all of a sudden, Wisconsin got some religion here, and all of a sudden they want it. Which I do too, because it'd be a lot more convenient for taxpayers on both sides of the border. So, and I can get you more information, but maybe I think they passed a law or the governor signed a law. We'll update you on that, Madam Chair, because I remember then after we did that ingenious David's motion, we did it, we put it into law. Then I started getting calls from Wisconsin legislators. Oh, but we really want to do this. We really want to do this with it. I told him to go pound sand on Wisconsin Public Radio because I'd had it with him. And I think that's as strong as the guy was pound sand. I think that was it on Wisconsin Public Radio. But I had no time for him because we had meeting after meeting after meeting. Let's get this done. Let's get it done. Let's get it done. Had the governors involved. And so that's how we took care of it. And the advantage of actually having tax reciprocity would be you only have to file one tax return. It would be much more convenient for taxpayers. And now on the Wisconsin side, they're saying, oh, David's kind of knew what he's talking about, which is rare. So with that being said, Madam Chair, that's something that could be coming, and I will get you an update on what they've actually done on the Wisconsin side. And being a kinder and gentler Greg Davids that now sees 1,000 points of light, I would be willing to visit with Wisconsin on this issue. And it's all none of the legislators that I told them to go pound sand, they're not there anymore. So we do have
waited them out.
Thank you, Madam Chair, right, for your indulgence, but it's a very important issue that could be coming forward.
Yeah, thank you very much, Representative Davids, for bringing that to my attention. better late than never for Wisconsin realizing your brilliance. And it sounds like we should have another conversation about this. Yes. And happy to work with you to help make this happen for some of those border communities, which I know a lot of us represent, and there's unique tax issues associated with them. So
thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. All right. With that, our next meeting is Tuesday, March 19th, same time and place. And with that, we are adjourned. Thank you.